Well, let's talk about 1968 for a year that ended up being so turbulent in so many ways. As you write in the book, it started very peacefully.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the problem with history is, you know, that books have a beginning and an end, but history just kind of flows.
Mm.
So, you know, years are kind of an arbitrary thing, so I start with January 1st and end with December 31st. And, you know, January started off relatively peacefully, but I would have to say that 1967 was not that peaceful a year, nor was 1969. You know, 1968 was the year that stood out with so many events, but it's not like it was unexpected that there would be troubles in 1968, because there were troubles in 1967.
Right, yeah. Forces were already percolating to turn it into such a challenging year, and at least from the American perspective, that was brought into focus with the Tet Offensive of late January. And is that something, first of all, that our military had any hint was coming?
Apparently not. They seem to have been taken completely by surprise. In fact, it took a long time for the military to understand what happened, because it didn't make any sense. It was basically a suicidal attack on the part of the Viet Cong. And it was hard to understand why they would do such a thing. But they did it for exactly what happened. I mean, it's the impact that it had on the American public. It really was kind of the end of the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong was destroyed by Tet and its aftermath, but its impact had, you know, it just really stepped up the resistance to the war.
Yeah, an absolute military failure, but in terms of changing American public opinion, and it was, of course, students who were already protesting in the streets, but even respected leaders, perhaps none more than Walter Cronkite, who did the special not long after his visit to Vietnam and essentially said that the only honorable way was for us to get out.
Yeah, which was, I talked to Cronkite about this. You know, it was a difficult thing for him to do. Because, you know, he was schooled in the neutral school of journalism. But it just seemed so overwhelming that Americans weren't getting the truth about what was happening. And, you know, Tet, yes, it was a military defeat, but, you know, it's the nature of television. Cronkite was a television guy, you know. Didn't look like a defeat on television. Nor did almost anything else going on there. It was the first war to be covered this way by television, and it didn't play very well. In fact, you know, war really isn't covered that way anymore, because there's no way for television to make it look good.
You were involved in the protests during the Vietnam War, and we've seen what young people can do. Are there any parallels, because people try to make them, between student activists of the 1960s and the young people involved in the March for Our Lives these days?
Yeah, there is a parallel. I mean, the young people, for some time, were trying to, they had this interest in the 60s. I would go around to schools and talk to students, for example, during the Iraq War, which is kind of the time frame that my book on 68 came out. And, you know, young people would say, you know, what can we do? And they wanted to understand what we had done so that they could do it. In time, they really moved beyond the idea of asking us, you know, and are just doing it on their own. But, you know, what they got out of the 60s is that young people can do it.
Was Lyndon Johnson in some way perhaps a victim himself of the Tet Offensive and that changing public opinion? Or had that already begun before that?
Well, in Johnson's mind, it certainly had. I mean, if you go back and look at tapes and letters and things, Johnson was always aware of the fact that this was politically a really bad thing. And he just didn't know how to get out of it. And, you know, he had conversations with politicians that he was close to about, this is a thing, this is just a disaster, and how can we get out of it? But he was caught up in the idea that, it would be politically unacceptable to just, in his mind, back down from a war. And also this notion that they used to call the domino theory, that, you let one country fall to communism and all the others will follow, which history showed to be complete nonsense.
We're talking with Mark Kurlansky, the author of 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. And the turbulence of that year was certainly not limited to the United States with all that happened with the Prague Spring and then the Soviet invasion, the Alexander Dubček experience. What was the most significant global event of 1968 from your perspective?
Well, I think you just named it. It was the Prague Spring. I think with the hindsight of history, that was the huge event of 1968 because it was the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. If Brezhnev had handled Dubček and the Prague Spring, and then Dubček was riding a wild thing, it was really the young people, and he was a good communist and a friend of the Soviet Union, and so were a lot of the people involved in the Prague Spring, and if Brezhnev had been able to see it as a friendly movement, not an enemy of the Soviet Union, history might have been very different. What he did instead was show everyone in the Soviet Union that Moscow would tolerate no dissent whatsoever, which, to young people at the time, it was an uncommunist idea. They were brought up, these people were communists, and they were brought up with the idea of communism. And part of the idea of communism was that you protest, and you're always reforming and changing things.
Well, and as you point out in the book, too, Dubček was of that generation who saw the Soviet communists as conquering heroes for their work in defeating Hitler.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, is that Czechoslovakia, more than any place else in Eastern Europe, had a closeness and a fondness for the Soviet Union. So, to use the military to invade that country, their closest ally, just really showed the Soviet Union in its worst light. And it never recovered. And Gorbachev, in his memoirs, talked about how, I think it was in 1970, it was a couple of years later, he was stationed in Prague, and he said that he realized that they had lost it, that nobody believed in them anymore.
The assassinations, only 2 months apart, of Martin Luther King Jr. in April, Bobby Kennedy in June, in many ways, was that the death of hope and optimism in America? Because I was only 10 years old at the time, but I remember family members who just threw their hands in the air as if, we're killing off our best people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was this very strong feeling that I think most of us had. I mean, I was a college student at the time, actually a volunteer for Bobby Kennedy. In a lot of ways, it seemed like the death of hope, because, for one thing, I mean, Bobby Kennedy was seen, by me and by people who supported him as hope, as a guy who really was going to stop the war. this was the way out of the whole mess, elect Bobby. And then he's shot. And after Kennedy was shot, I mean, Gene McCarthy didn't have really any chance of getting the Democratic nominee. So you got nomination. So you got Hubert Humphrey. So you basically had two parties. After everything, you had two candidates running for president, neither of whom opposed the war.
And you had in Nixon someone appealing to, I think we can say in history, in the retrospect that history affords us, that he appealed to the base instincts when he talked about law and order. There was a racist overtone to that. It was an anti-youth message. And then you had the violence in the streets of Chicago, which was the ultimate clash between the old school of Richard Daley and the young people protesting the war.
Yeah, and, you know, it really changed American politics. I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but political conventions used to be really interesting.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And they'd go into them, you know, and all the different candidates would have their delegates, and anything could happen. If a candidate did not win on the first ballot, then there was a lot of horse trading for delegates, and who knew who would end up with it. And the Democratic Convention in Chicago was the last convention like that.
Right, and that led to the reforms that were enacted in 72, which really took the hands out of a larger group of people and made it a bit more controlled and not as interesting and certainly not as chaotic.
Yeah, I mean, it turned the national conventions into coronations. I mean, you no longer have any doubt who the nominee is going to be when you start the convention, and you have this whole choreographed program of, what is it, 4 days, which is about, you know, launching the candidate. It didn't used to be about launching the candidate. It used to be about picking a candidate.
That race in 68 was so close, and it got closer and closer as Election Day drew. Yeah, it's tough to speculate, but would the world have been, or would America have been, a different place if Hubert Humphrey and Ed Muskie had won that election?
You know, that is an interesting question. Well, I suppose it would have been. You wouldn't have had Watergate. I don't know that the Vietnam War would have turned out any differently. If Kennedy hadn't been shot and he had gotten the nomination, I think the history of America could have been entirely different.
So, Mark, as we look back 50 years, what ways did 1968 fundamentally change America?
It psychologically changed America in a lot of ways. It made a lot of people much more cynical about government, but it also implanted an idea, you know, which goes away but keeps coming back, that you have to stand up for what you believe in. And, you know, after 68, this country was kind of exhausted. You know, it just kind of almost went to sleep. And if you look at the Reagan years, and I mean, Reagan was doing extremely harmful things to the poor, and he was killing lots of people in Central America, and he was as devastating to the environment as Donald Trump is. And, you know, there weren't protests. But that idea sat there, you know, for a generation. And, you know, kids now are saying, you know, we need to do what was done in the 60s.
Mark, I'm a big fan of so many of your books. It's great to talk with you. We appreciate you making time for us this afternoon, and I look forward to reading Havana.
Okay, great. Nice talking to you.